In a modern, pragmatic world of smartphones and tech upgrades, artisanal crafts and hand-painted traditions of yesteryear seem to be fading away. But take a step outside of the bustling megapolis of Moscow, and you'll find that traditional Russian folk arts culture is still going strong. We start in Kolomna, just about 100 kilometers outside of Moscow, where they are known for making a delicious treat called apple pastilla. Believe it or not, the recipes and technology for making it had been lost and forgotten, but the town rallied and revived their pastilla heritage. So, pastilla, you could describe it as a marshmallow, you could describe it as a souffle, but it's not any of those things, really. What exactly is pastilla?
There were a lot of apples in the fall, and the fruit was processed, turned into apple puree, and then the puree was spread on paper and dried. This is essentially medieval canning. That's how the crops were preserved. There were no jars, no special lids, no modern technology in the Middle Ages. They did what they could. They could dry it out on a rag, on a cloth, they could put it on glass or on the roof. Any way they could get the juice out of the mashed apples.
So why Kolomna specifically? Why here is it important to revive this art?
Kolomna was engaged in cultivating, producing beautiful and delicious varieties of apples. How can you tell if an apple is good or not? You have to wait for the harvest, which is why the orchards were enormous. During the fruit season, there were a lot of crops. Kolomna was teeming with apples. People quickly realized that in a couple of months, there would be no fruit left, so it needed to be processed and preserved. So Kolomna was renowned for its orchards, consequently yielding an enormous amount of fruit. And Russians usually tend to use everything without any waste. That's why this became a tradition precisely in Kolomna, but not in the neighboring old towns. There was no pastilla there because there weren't any orchards.
Now, my understanding is the technology to make pastilla the way you do was pretty much lost. And you had to revive that technology, find out how it was done. Talk to me about that process. How did you do it?
It all started out of curiosity, like searching for treasure. The technology had been lost. What we're engaged in is an intangible heritage. The sense, the tastes, the way of speaking, the culture of everyday life. These fleeting technologies are undeniably part of our heritage as well. So we embarked on a mission to reclaim this technology. But it was difficult and a lengthy process. It didn't come easily at all. The puree burned at first, spat in big globs onto the ceiling, scorched our hands until we discovered, in our national library, that there were special Kessler boilers. Essentially, they created this kind of thermos with a double bottom, where water was poured in, and in these devices, puree was cooked down to a thick consistency before being spread out. Kolomna went a step further than other cities in Russia that produced pastilla. Someone came up with the idea of adding whipped egg white to the apple puree, and the mixture transformed into apple sponge cake. It was white, fluffy, soft. In Europe, there was no equivalent product. We all know about chocolate's origins in countries like Switzerland, Belgium, France, and so on. However, Europe has never made these airy whipped pastillas, and still don't to this day. And that's why we confidently, ambitiously say that Kolomna pastilla, airy whipped pastilla, is 100% our national product.
More than the technology, there has to be a personal buy-in for the culture, the people, to have the skills to do this, that were traditionally passed down from generation to generation. How do you revive the culture and the buy-in to making pastilla as well?
Traditionally, it was like this: a master and his apprentice. A child at a conscious age, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, would stand by the master and absorb, as if through their skin, through their eyes, what the elder was doing. The child was an apprentice, and over time, they turned into a master. There was no need to formally teach them. They were learning through observation. The culture of production became ingrained in their consciousness. Now it's pretty much the same. There are no textbooks on making kolomna pastila. So people come to the production factory, observe, and that's how they learn. Nothing has changed. It's as old as time. And so currently we have about 30 confectioners working with us. And we hope that this knowledge, these technologies, will never disappear again for another 90 years as it happened in Kolomna.
This is technically a sweet. A confection, if you will. But you don't call yourselves confectioners. What do you call yourselves exactly?
I think we're museum curators, cultural experts. Let me explain why. Because we don't create just any sweets. We're only interested in what history has, what is connected to the DNA of Russia, to the DNA of Kolomna, to such a cultural code, something that is forgotten and lost to us, and undeservedly so.
So, Natasha, here inside the museum, it's quite unique, but it's a little bit unusual because you don't have exhibits, per se. I would call it more of a living museum. Tell me, what do you have here?
Our medium is taste. We use flavors to tell the story of Kolomna, to convey the spirit of this place, and to share Russian history. So our main exhibit is the collection of historical flavors that we've brought back to life. We've revived old techniques, and we're preserving them as a kind of intangible heritage kept alive by the hands of our bakers, who maintain skills that have otherwise been forgotten.
Okay, so I have to ask, with everything that is offered today, with preservatives, and we have Milky Way, Twix, and all sorts of different things out there to offer, what makes pastilla so special?
You know, sometimes people even ask us, what do you put in there that makes it so addictive? I think the secret is very simple. We overload our taste receptors with flavor enhancers, additives. We've become accustomed to the products offered to us by supermarkets. When pastilla returned to Kolomna 10, even 15 years ago, it was a surprise for everyone. It's natural, with low sugar. What attracts women is the absence of flour, fat, and sugar in high concentrations.
It seems to me, coming here to Kolomna, with the apples and the samovar and just the setting, it kind of takes you back in time to a different time. Is this kind of your aim, your goal?
Look at the architecture around here. This part of the city seems to be stuck in the 19th century, some provincial town that hasn't quite made it even to the 20th century. There's history in every cobblestone, in every house, and people are not allowed to do whatever they want with their houses here, even if it's their private property. Thanks to this, we have this very Russian, very old city.
Thank you very much. By the way, what I have here in my hand is also quite special. Let's head to another place and find out more. One of the most recognized designs in Russia, the white and blue porcelain of Gizel. Some even call it the embodiment of the Russian artistic spirit. So how does a simple piece of clay take the form of something so beautiful and delicate? Sergei, hi, nice to meet you. Thanks for letting us come and speak to you about this beautiful place. I guess I want to start by asking, porcelain is treasured throughout the world. We have China with their Ming, we have even Delft Blue in Holland. What makes your pottery here so special?
Gizel is a truly unique tradition. Its blue and white style initially imitated Dutch faience, which was imported into Russia during Peter the Great's reign. He aimed to develop a domestic equivalent to that fashionable Dutch pottery. However, once porcelain was introduced, the styles and techniques evolved significantly. The painting here has its own style, its own images. Russian artisans paint each flower and every element within it with single brush strokes. We're in a provincial city in the Moscow region, and this is essentially a rural folk tradition. The local people have their own perception of beauty, which has led to the development of this distinctly unique painting style.
Now, it is said that you here in Russia have created your own recipe for the porcelain itself. Is that true? And if so, do you still use that recipe today?
Russia did develop its own porcelain. It's not an imported recipe. And what's funny, Empress Elizabeth said, "Don't make the porcelain too thin. We don't want people to think we're skimping on materials." Porcelain was very expensive at the time, but Russia had ample resources, so it didn't really hurt to make it a little thicker. Our porcelain typically features a decorative ornamental style with floral patterns. The color scheme we mostly use today is the one that was adopted 60 or 70 years ago, with the dominant color pair of white and blue. But we use other colors as well. The formula for these paints is our factory secret. We develop them ourselves. We fire the porcelain at a temperature of 1,350 degrees C, and these colors don't burn out. These paints are forever. They're encased beneath a layer of glaze, so they stay vibrant and resistant to mechanical damage. That's what makes porcelain so unique and so expensive.
Just judging by from what I see here, I'm really anxious to see what else is in store. Do you mind showing us around?
Yes, let's go.
Now, Sergei, in English, we have a phrase, "I feel like a bull in a china shop with all of this porcelain surrounding me." That's kind of what I feel like right now. But porcelain is very delicate. There's a lot of nuances to working with it. So what do you do to make sure that all of this stuff doesn't break?
It's very important that the person casting a porcelain piece feels the material and feels how dry or wet it is. It's also important to be good with your hands. 80% of our work is manual, so your handiwork is everything. Casting is one of the operations that requires real skill. We use plaster molds just like anywhere else in the world. The technology used in this process is the same as you'd see anywhere. You cut the sprue like this.
And you're just using your hands to just make sure it's all done properly.
While the item is wet, you can do anything you want with it. You can perforate it to make a lace rim or apply any other style, but you must be careful not to let it dry out. Once it's dry, you can't do anything with it. Any craftsman who works with clay is a bit of a sculptor. You have to use your hands constantly to get the right geometry. You cut off excess material. You plaster on handles or spouts if you're working on a teapot. You can also decorate elements with whole figures. Here's a teapot lid with a bear. You cast the bear separately and then put it on the lid like this. And you have a bear-themed teapot. Almost all our technical operations are done by hand, including painting.
The fire, the clay, the colors, it's all sort of like magic. Let's take a look at one of the most intriguing steps, the work of the artists. Thank you for taking the time to look inside your workshops. Really fascinating. I guess I have to ask, you work in color, and we are used to seeing the Gzhel designs only in white and blue, but originally they were all in color. Can you tell us a little bit about the history there?
That's right. The gel tradition began with maiolica and faience painted in a variety of colors. Working in color is more difficult because each color needs a special approach. Each has its own nuances that must be taken into account during the process.
I know with the cobalt paint, it burns off to give it that, it goes from black to blue. Do the paints in the color vision burn off as well? What's the secret with the painting here?
The color stays almost the same, but becomes much more vivid. Right now, as you can see, it's almost like a watercolor. After firing, the watercolor effect is gone. The color becomes denser.
So after this is fired and there's the final glazing, does this mean that your painting, the work that you do here, will last forever?
Yes, once the item is glazed, the image stays there forever, as if encased in glass.
That has to be satisfying as an artist. While traditions here are well kept, Gazelle is also getting a modern twist with the help of a designer, Sergei Sisoyev, turning it from your grandma's china to designer ceramics. What exactly inspires you about Gazelle and the Gazelle design?
Gazelle is an ancient Russian craft that I felt needed to be revitalized and re-explored. So I studied its traditions deeply and infused them with new life.
What about the designs themselves? What was your idea behind these designs?
I tried to look at traditional things in a new way. For example, I took the classic Agashka rose pattern that's traditionally painted by all Gazelle artists, made it larger, and turned it into the centerpiece of the design. I found it surprising that traditional Gazelle painting never included any representation of wheat heads in its designs, so I added that. And I also added some elements of traditional design patterns that were used elsewhere, like on traditional Russian summer and winter garments.
There seems to be a contradiction, or maybe a balance, actually, between old and new. Can modern designs actually help preserve the old traditions?
Unless they have the capacity to transform and adapt, traditions die. When new generations are born, they have a need to see something they can relate to in traditional things.
Now, are you going to stick with Gazelle, or do you have any ideas about future projects going back to past traditional designs?
Working with Gazelle was my first folk arts and crafts collaboration project. After that, I worked with the Zhostova artists who produced the most beautiful trays decorated with floral designs, and I gave them a modern twist too.
Zhostova is a town which has been creating iconic trays. A well-known motif of bright flowers on dark varnished iron sheets has become their trademark. It has been around for about two centuries and stayed just as it was in the late 1800s. Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for taking the time to...
Happy to welcome you.
...talk us through this history. So these plates, they have made their way into the collections of the Hermitage, and they've become famous. And they are very beautiful, but how did they go from just being a work of art to a masterpiece of Russian culture?
The special Zhostova painting technique creates this unique image. That's what made the Zhostova tray so famous. And the artists, the painters themselves, because each tray is a unique creation by an individual artist. No two pieces are the same. In essence, when the artist is gone, that particular special design is gone and only lives in the pieces he or she left behind. No one else can reproduce the exact same design. Every artist does something unique, and that also adds to the tray's value.
Now, I know it's not just about the artists. It's also about the metalsmiths. And many people go into the creation of one tray. So how many hands does a product go through until you actually have the finished product?
Well, let's see. If we're talking about metal trays, then the process starts with a smith. Then a varnisher applies a black layer. First, they clean and degrease the tray and then apply black enamel paint. If the tray has to be a different color, they apply a layer of colored enamel paint on top of that. That's two people, right? Then the tray gets its floral design. That's where the artist comes in. When that is done, a different artist adds the golden borderline pattern using a very small brush and gold paste. And finally, the tray is varnished again. So that's at least five people, but sometimes even more people work on one piece.
Now, so it really is all about teamwork. I understand that this specific type of art is not easy to replicate. What makes this type of painting style so unique?
There was an outstanding artist, Vyacheslav Litkov. He always said, do not try to compete with nature. You can never win this competition. Nature does things that no artist can do. That's why we don't try to replicate nature, but we observe it and interpret its creations, turning natural elements into decorations. What we do is a decorative interpretation of nature, every tiny detail of it.
So this is a pretty impressive piece, just in terms of size and scope. So I guess I have to ask, if you have a name or if you've created a name in any sphere, that means there's going to be people trying to imitate what you do. Do you have imposters who are trying to bank on your name? And how do we know that if we're purchasing something, we're getting an original from here?
Zhostova artists keep improving their skills and technique all their life. After you've visited our production site and the museum, you'll have no problem identifying the authentic Zhostova pieces.
There are only a couple of dozen artists who have mastered this art. Every tray is unique, painted by hand. Thank you for letting us come in and take a look at what you do up close, because I've been watching you paint and it is just mesmerizing. So I've been told that to paint in the Zhostova style, you have to live on this soil. What do you think about that?
Of course, it helps a lot. The atmosphere in this place, everything around us is very inspiring. And being here as part of the team of artists is like having a family.
I know that the Zhostova brushstroke is its own unique thing, but also the brushes themselves are different from others. Can you talk to me about why?
We use squirrel hair brushes that are made by master brushmakers in the town of Kirov. They have a factory that makes them. They have unique properties because squirrel hair has to be collected during a particular season, either in the summer or winter. Outside of those seasons, the hair loses a certain quality. Also, you can see that it's a flat brush that's very thin if I look from the side. That's what allows us to make these famous Zhostova brush strokes.
So what about the designs themselves? Is there a standard uniform design that you have to follow, or do you as an artist get to create what you like?
We don't have any kind of a mandatory pattern. Every artist is free to paint whatever they like. I choose the designs for my trays. A fellow artist will choose whatever designs they would like to paint. That's what makes them all unique. We don't have any standardized patterns or designs. The only thing we have in common is the Zhostova style of painting. That's what all of us have to stick to. The style is about where and how we arrange the elements on the tray, and the combination of colors is also important. Every tray must feature all of the colors, including yellow, blue, white, and pink, to have this festive look. So it takes each artist a lot of imagination to come up with unique designs within the framework of this distinct style.